I've worked with children most of my adult life, but the last job I had was at California Lutheran College, where I taught early childhood curriculum is the word I'm trying to think of. Early childhood curriculum and research. And I've also been working with a number of parenting groups through the years. Earlier in my career, I had lab school at Augustana College, where we trained teachers and taught four-year-olds. We've been coming up to Holden for 20 years now, and I've been doing my parenting thing, as you can see by the tapes in the library. So, but this year I hope I've come up with something just a little bit different. We are so prone to follow fads and new theories in child rearing. I've done it myself and have made some horrible mistakes by just doing what the authorities say should be done. An illustration of that was 42 years ago when our oldest child was born. They said, do not feed your child oftener than every four hours. The poor child had to cry for an hour to be fed. And I've been disgusted with myself ever since. Ever since I found out there are other ways to do it. There's also that common sense ingredient that we must use, and which my mother kept telling me, oh, but that doesn't make sense to let the child cry for an hour. But that was a theory in those times. So since then, I've been trying to gather what makes sense to me. And I know when our first child was born, as I said, I went by the book. When the second child was born, I still used the book some, but I also mixed it with common sense. When the third child came along, I just threw away the book. I'd like to use, as an opening, a prayer by Gary Myers. Some of the older people here might remember Gary Myers as the founder of Highlights for Children magazine. And I thought this parent's prayer was so apropos, I'm going to use it. Oh, Heavenly Father, make me a better parent. Teach me to understand my children, to listen patiently to what they have to say, and to answer all their questions kindly. Keep me from interrupting them or contradicting them. Make me as courteous to them as I would have them be to me. Forbid that I should ever laugh at their mistakes or resort to shame or ridicule when they displease me. May I never punish them for my own selfish satisfaction or to show my power. Let me not tempt my child to lie or steal, and guide me hour by hour that I may demonstrate by all I say and do that honesty produces happiness. Reduce, I pray, the meanness in me, and when I am out of sorts, help me, O Lord, to hold my tongue. May I ever be mindful that my children are children, and I should not expect of them the judgment of adults. Let me not rob them of the opportunity to wait on themselves and to make decisions. Bless me with the bigness to grant them all their reasonable requests, and the courage to deny them privileges I know will do them harm. Make me fair and just and kind, and fit me, O Lord, to be loved and respected and imitated by my children. Amen. I've often said that you don't find out what kind of a parent you've been until you see what kind of a parent your parents your children are. then you see your mistakes and also some of the right things that you must have done along the way. Before I go any further, I know I'll forget it unless I stop and tell you about it now, but Mary, one of Mary's requests in the bookstore is to push your own stuff. And so if I don't do it, nobody else will. So these are files that idea files for teachers and parents of young children. Oh, usually from 3 to 8. And a little songbook that correlates the song with activities. I'm very much a believer that young children learn a lot more by doing than just by listening. And if you want to come up and look at them afterwards, you're welcome. Otherwise, just look at them in the bookstore. I based these remarks on an article by Charles Schaefer, who went about interviewing parents whom he felt had done a real good job. All these parents were older people whose children were in their 20s and above. And he asked them this question: based upon your personal experiences with your own children, what is the best advice you can give new parents about rearing children? And it was amazing the number of things that they came up with that they agreed upon. And these are the things that I'm basing my remarks on. Experienced parents are most likely to know what really works. We have too many theorists who don't even have any children. And it's the ones who have, I really believe you should read the child rearing how to do books. I think we should read the psychologists, read the child developmentalists, find out how your children grow at each age level. I think that's one of the most valuable things that we can do, is to just know what we can expect of our children. Much of the child abuse we have these days is due to the fact that parents don't know what children at certain ages can be expected to know and do. The first thing that was mentioned, and I know you all know this, but this is it: love abundantly. And according to all these parents, the first and most important task is to love and really care about children. This is not only gives the child a sense of security, belonging, and support, but it also smooths out the rough edges of childhood. Parental love should be special in two respects. First, it should be constant and unconditional. No matter how naughty a child gets, maybe we don't like them so well, but we still love them and we stick by them regardless of what they do. And they need to know that we're there and we're going to stick by them. Secondly, parents should be open in expressing and showing love so that children are never uncertain about its presence. This means parents should love, hug, and praise their children every time it occurs to them, and not worry about spoiling the children. That's comforting for grandparents to know, because we're so often accused of spoiling the kids. But you can't spoil them by loving them too much. Don't forget to tell the children that you love them and keep them aware of this love. I had a father who attended one of my sessions one summer, and he was telling about the sad experience he'd had with his little girl. He said, "I was so strict and I was expecting so much of her that all of a sudden she didn't like me anymore and she avoided me. And when we did have any in relations, it was very hostile." Finally, he went to a psychologist and wanted to know how in the world he could restore this relationship. And the psychologist said, "Just stop criticizing. Look for the good things that your daughter does and brag about those things that she does right. And he said it took only 2 weeks until that relationship was restored and she was again a loving daughter. Parents made these comments in regard to the importance of loving. Children should be caressed both physically and verbally, and they should know that they are loved because of the special qualities that make them individuals and the individuals that they are becoming. In other words, we shouldn't compare our children to another sibling who might be smarter or prettier. Well, you know that. I don't feel that I should even have to mention this. But I think that one thing that some fathers have the idea that they shouldn't hug their sons because that's an effeminate thing to do. And another, I'll draw again on an experience with a parent who, it was a grandmother. She said, "I know I'm the reason for this, and I feel so badly and so guilty." But she said, "You know, my grandson will not let his daddy do anything for him." But she says, "I know why. He isn't gentle and caressing and loving with that son. And we brought him up with the idea that that isn't male, you know, that isn't macho to show that softness. And for that reason, when he dresses him, and makes such a job out of it that it isn't fun for his little two-year-old son. So his little two-year-old son won't let him put on his socks or help him dress. And so fortunately, the daddy was there and we talked about it. And I'm hoping now that they have been able to patch that up because the grandmother saw what was happening. Discipline means teaching. A lot of times we think discipline means punishment, but it doesn't. Setting and adhering to standards. After love, the parents stressed the importance of giving clear directions and enforcing limits on a child's behavior. When administered out of love, discipline is an essential preparation for adjusting to the outside world. It not only makes a child better behaved, but happier as well. It is best to use the positive approach by saying, "Do this," more often than "Don't do that." Also, when a child does not comply with the direction, be certain that you punish when you say you will. Be firm by saying what you mean and meaning what you say. I found that in the little preschoolers that I taught, the problem was with parents who didn't take the time to see the instructions through, to see the task accomplished. They'd say it and then go off, and the child would do it if he felt like it, he wouldn't do it if he didn't feel like it. And those children had to be taught after they got to preschool that what you say, they must listen to, and then they must do it. And so much of my parent counseling was on this very thing. Sometimes they thought their child really was deaf, but he wasn't. He just found it was smarter not to hear, because then he could get by with not doing what he was told. And then if you're going to punish, do it right after the mistake, and don't wait until daddy comes home to do the dirty work. Apart from firmness and immediacy, the parents describe the following qualities as constructive discipline. Be consistent. Don't undermine the rules set by your spouse. Oh, that's so important. Disagreements regarding child rearing must be resolved in privacy, never in front of the children. Be clear. Establish a few rules and spell them out clearly in advance. There should be no confusion on the part of the child. And here again, this was a principle that I felt was so important in the nursery school. Right off the bat, we set the boundaries. And that was it. We didn't have to talk about it after that. Parents would come and talk to me about their child, and I'd brag and say he was so great, and we enjoyed him so much, and he behaved so well. He said, "Are you sure that you're talking about my kid? Because at home, he doesn't mind." Well, I think the problem was that he didn't get the clear messages, and that the parents did not see to it that he adhered to those messages. Of course, in the nursery school, we have the advantage because children kind of discipline each other. They say, "You're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to play in that tree or go in that room at this time." Then, if you do punish, they suggest that you administer in private. Never punish a child in front of anyone. Never shame him. I know of one adult who had real difficulty in his marriage. And he used to tell about his grandmother. His grandmother took care of him while his mother went to work. And he said when he did something naughty, she would tie him to the tree in the front yard so that children come by could make fun of him. Now that's child abuse. And yet she thought it was in the name of discipline and bringing him up right. As a consequence, it may not have been just that, but he was a very disturbed person. Extremely disturbed, and had such a bad self-concept. Be reasonable and understanding. Explain the reason why a child is being given directions. The stove is hot. Keep away and you will not be burned. However, don't be afraid on occasion to say it, do it because I said so. In addition, try to understand a child's point of view and meet him or her halfway. This will give you a much closer relationship. He has to feel that you're with him, you're his friend or her friend. Be flexible, and this is of course especially true with adolescents. Bargaining is an effective tool. Talk it over and decide what the give and take is going to be. On occasion, it's good for both parents and child to be able to bend the rules a little. Don't be too rigid. And of course, many parents make this mistake. They think they're being good parents when they're really so rigid that the child is rebelling inside. I know I had a little boy who came to school with his fists clenched every Monday morning. And he was out to flay out at anybody who got in his way. Finally, I decided I'd better talk to his parents and find out what was going on at home. They were both educated people, teachers. And when I talked with them, I found out they had a new house, new furniture, a yard that was just seeded. So, of course, the child couldn't live in the house like a child should be able to. He was not allowed to run out in the grass or in the seeded lawn. I asked the father, I said, "Don't you play with him?" "Well, no, not really." He said, "I let him sit and watch me make cabinets down in the workshop." And I said, "Well, you're cutting off your communication with this child at a very early age, when really communication is very easy with a four-year-old." But he was so hostile inside. He just had to get even with the world because his dad and his mother had him living in a world of shoulds and you should nots. And I said, "Do you let him make any decisions at all? A four-year-old? What kind of decisions can a four-year-old make?" "Well, he can decide what he's going to wear to school in the morning. He can put his school clothes in a certain place and let him pick out what he wants." There are a lot of little decisions that you can let him in on that the family makes about picnics and where they're going to go. And they got to thinking. And finally, the father said, you know, we really want to do a good job with this kid. He's all we've got. And every time he goes to school, he leaves from home, I always say, now be a good boy today, Mark. And I said, oh, next time, just say, have fun today, Mark. Have fun. And, you know, it's just amazing. They were intelligent parents. All I needed was a suggestion. You see, we train people to do every other kind of job except be parents. And we do need parent groups to talk about these things and help each other with our problems, because our problems are usually, especially if they're about the same age, they're pretty much the same. I think every church should have a parent training group going on constantly, because it's the type of parenting that we do that will determine the kind of people we raise. Stress discipline, you will find it much easier and really fun to bring up children who know what they can and cannot do. Children appreciate knowing what the score is. Consistency is all important in discipline. Rules that are not meant to be enforced should not be made. A sense of order helps develop a sense of security. And you see, if this is done consistently, then the child learns self-discipline. Nobody has to stand on the outside and tell him what to do, because he knows inside himself what should be done. Then another one that I'm sure you all know because you're here. Spend lots of time with your children. That was a frequent recommendation by these skilled parents. The parents felt that this personal involvement should be multifaceted, including such interactions as playing. Mark's dad needed to get out with a baseball and a bat or a football or something with Mark to play with him, and talking together. Have real dialogues with the kids. Times when you both listen and sincerely react to one another. We always felt that bedtime was a very special time for this kind of thing. Usually the bedtime routine made going to bed a happy time of day, because they got their Bible story, they got their, usually a story out of the Book of Knowledge, and maybe a child's little story, and then the prayers. And this was such a good time to talk things over and find out what was on the child's mind. We should have one time of day when we do this, and you can pick your own. I remember one little boy who chose Sunday noon dinner. He requested that he make the prayer on Sunday noon, and he reiterated all of his complaints about to God about what had been going on in the family that he didn't feel was right as far as he was concerned. So they let him do that, because you know, a four-year-old is quite often ignored in a family conversation. I remember one mother said that her little child just put up her hand every time she wanted to talk, because nobody would listen to her unless she made them pay attention to her to begin with. Teaching. Actively teach your children workaday skills like cooking. Let them help you mix things and repairing things. Car repair when they get older is an invaluable skill to learn. Then have family activities. Celebrate. Find out, make any excuse to celebrate. When they fly up from Brownies to Girl Scouts, celebrate. You don't necessarily have to go out and eat someplace special, but you might have that child's favorite dessert. Just make it a feeling of celebration. I know We really run it into the ground in our family. We celebrate really ridiculous things sometimes, but it's fun. And I find that our daughters, we have three daughters, and they have families, and they do the same thing. That quite often when we call them, well, they're celebrating. Todd made this particular, I remember when he was having such problems with math, and he finally did the test in the proper length of time and got them all right, and so he brought the paper home, and they went out to his favorite place to eat, and who should walk in but his math teacher. And she got the biggest kick out of the fact that they were celebrating the math paper, but he had worked so hard on that. And then the next time he got a perfect paper, she wrote a little note, "Where are we going to eat tonight?" But this is what makes life worthwhile. This makes it makes a time, a happy time. And really, it's our duty, all of us, to have a happy home. We set the tone. I can remember one little boy who came down to breakfast, and they said, "Well, what's wrong with you?" "Oh," he said, "I don't know." He said, "When I come down for breakfast, nobody says, 'Hello, Joe. Good morning, Joe. How are you feeling today, Joe?' All they say is, 'Have you gone to the toilet yet?'" We don't realize some of the things we say and what kind of a tone it sets for the rest of the day. And it's so easy to say something pleasant and happy and make the child feel that he's important. And it just takes a little thought. Of course, some of us are morning people, and it's easy. People who aren't morning people have a little trouble with that. But we have to work at it a little harder. It goes to social and sporting events and religious events together. You know, you don't know what it does for a child to get to sit in his daddy's lap all during the service. Oh, you know that daddies are busy and they don't always have time to hold you in their lap. But it's amazing how relaxed a little child can feel on Sunday morning during the service, especially with mommy on the other side and maybe a big sister or brother along. But they have a feeling of family unity. We're in this together. It's sort of a glue that holds a family together, I sincerely believe. Conduct family council meetings and make decisions together. One parent recommended that families reduce the TV watching by playing family games, father included, or by playing musical instruments together. Another said, "You can't fool children by giving them things, toys, TV, rather than your time and your attention." We had more fun this summer when we were taking a trip with our grandchildren and their parents on a boat. We were on the, it was just a sailboat. It was no luxury cruise, but we had some time, and we taught the children how to play chicken foot with dominoes. Has anybody learned how to play chicken foot here? Do you know how to play chicken foot? Great. Well, anyway, it was a game that they enjoyed as much as we did. And it was a time for laughter and togetherness. And we need to look for games like that that make everybody a winner. Nobody is really a loser. Tend to personal and marital needs. A number of parents specified that personal adjustment was an important prerequisite to effective child rearing. One noted that to relate well to children, adults must be comfortable with themselves. Another parent said that one should not completely sacrifice oneself for the family, but rather keep part of yourself for yourself. importance of letting their children know how delighted they are when their spouses enter the house. The morning greeting and the goodnight kiss set an atmosphere which encourages the same kind of affection in the hearts and minds of the children. A husband and wife are apt to be very successful parents when they give the totality of their and do something you enjoy. By treating yourself well, this parent felt that you will avoid the feeling of being mistreated. Oh, the martyr mother. Oh, no, there's nothing more pathetic than the martyr mother who does everything for the family. And let the kids wait on you a little bit. They'll feel better about themselves. They'll become better people. Love, respect, and faithfulness between spouses provide needed security to the family. Two comments by parents seem particularly helpful. A household in which love is openly expressed is a household in which children flourish. Verbalizing love to one's children is not enough. Parents should make every effort to let their youngsters see warmth and tenderness in their marital relationship. Parents should not underestimate the importance of letting their children know how delighted they are when their spouses enter the house. The morning greeting and the goodnight kiss set an atmosphere which encourages the same kind of affection in the hearts and minds of the children. A husband and wife are apt to be very successful parents when they give the totality of their marriage the first priority. It may seem that the children are getting second best from this approach, but they rarely are. A happy mother and father are most apt to have happy children whose roles are clearly and lovingly defined. Child-centered households produce neither happy marriages nor happy children. And what about the apron strings? Now, there can be extremes here, and I counseled a mother whose child was rebelling terribly. The nursery teachers called me and asked me if I would talk to her. And I said, well, what does a child do? Well, she says, he does everything mean to me he can think of. And she said, now he wants, he insists that his, he was three, he insists that his high chair be turned toward the wall when he eats. And I said, well, have you been including him in the family conversation? She says, no, I'm afraid maybe we haven't. He's only three. I said, yes, but if you're excluding him, there are things you can talk about that when he is there that you can include him in. And you and your husband have time later to talk. She says, I know, but when the husband comes home, we usually sit right down to supper, and we have so many things that we want to say to each other about what's been going on during the day that she said, I'm afraid that we have shut him out. So here is an extreme of shutting a child out, which certainly doesn't make for a child's feeling of worth. And she was expecting another baby too, and so they needed to get this thing straightened out now before another baby came along. But I think that I talked to the teachers later about the child, and they said, oh, well, he's fine. He's doing great. So apparently they changed some of their behavior at home and made all the difference in the world. Specific comments of parents include the following. Children should be made aware of proper values, behavioral, financial, and so forth. When they stray, parents should communicate in a manner which encourages the child to listen. Don't be permissive or rigid, but firm, so the children know exactly where you stand. Teach children to respect people, to be honest, to treat others as they themselves would like to be treated. All children have to be taught right from wrong. Respect for others, for their property, and respect for older people. Teach them the value of truthfulness. Time again and again, I recall telling the children if they told us the truth about a situation, we would do all in our power to help them. For in knowing the real facts, we could deal with any misstatements by others. If, however, they lied, we would be unable to be of much help because we couldn't depend on them. Now, there's a fine line between lying and imagination. And I think parents should recognize this, too, when they're three and four. They quite often make up enormous stories. And they've been given an imagination that will stand them in good stead as they get older, because without an imagination, they can't have very productive lives. I remember one little boy kept talking about the lions and the animals kept him awake all night. They roared and roared, and he just couldn't sleep. Well, right away I thought, oh, we better help him here a little bit to separate truth from fiction. So I talked to him. I said, are you sure it was lions? Yes, it was. So I talked to his mother. We didn't pursue it any further, fortunately, because I talked to his mother, and she said, oh, you know, we just moved from so-and-so, and we lived across from the zoo. So you never know. Now, I remember when our middle daughter was three, we had a whale in the attic, and it was very real to her. Everybody can't, but that was really imagination. There was no whale in our attic, but she told everybody who came that there was. But it was she was the one who was always saying things with her tongue in her cheek. She loved a joke, and this what it was, just a fun joke. And there we need to tolerate that sort of thing. And it's the same thing with stealing. We should be very hesitant to call it stealing if the child brings a toy home from nursery school or something. I know I had a little girl who kept carrying a piece of a puzzle she took ridiculous things that she couldn't play with at home. But I found out it was the days when she had a pocket. She needed something to put in the pocket. But her mother would call and say, oh, she did it again. Do you think she's going to be a kleptomaniac? I said, oh no, we'll talk about it this morning. She said, well, that's the trouble, she said. When I scolded her about taking this toy, she says, oh dear, I guess Mrs. Edmund and I'll have to have another little talk. So when she came in and handed me the toy, I said, and now let's play a game. I said, you be Mrs. Edmund, and I'll be Laurie. And I took the toy and I said, here, Mrs. Edmund, I don't know why I took this home. I know I couldn't play with it at home, and I know you need it for the puzzle here in school. So I'm not going to take anything like this home anymore. Well, Laurie was taken aback. She put her hands on her hips and she said, I'm Laurie. You're Mrs. Edmund. But she didn't ever take anything again. So we never know what's going to work. But that wasn't stealing. Laura was taking those things home because she had a pocket. And we need to look at all angles before we start labeling our children as either liars or thieves. That's very serious business, to lay that on a child and make it part of that child's self-image. We need to teach them the value of truthfulness, of course. And as a child develops, he is more and more able to handle the truth and realize the importance of the truth. Then the parents emphasize the need to insist that all family members treat each other with respect. First of all, this means that parents should act in respectful ways to the children. Do we insist on thank you and please, but we don't say it ourselves? Quite often happens. The following behaviors exemplify this respect. Politeness to children by saying excuse me and apologizing to a child. We need to admit we make mistakes once in a while, because then we leave room for them to make mistakes, and when they make mistakes, they don't need to lie about it because we didn't lie about it. I remember in teaching the little children, I would quite often purposely make an obvious mistake. And I said, boy, did I goof that time. That's okay, Mrs. Edmund, that's okay, we all goof. And that's the attitude that needs to permeate a home, I think. The freedom to make mistakes is one of the greatest freedoms in the world. And then we must follow through with any promises we make and show basic trust in a child's judgment and character. In addition, parents should insist on being treated in a respectful way by their children, and this means consistent. Don't ever let a child get by with sassing you, because if they get by once, they're going to do it again. Don't tolerate sassing. On the other hand, be respectful in the way we correct our children. Be courteous in correcting our children. I remember one little boy and girl were playing with a with a playhouse, and the little girl said that she would be the father, and the little boy decided to be the mother. And the mother was stirring around in the kitchen of the dollhouse and looked out the window and said, "Well, here comes the old fool now." Sort of got a picture of that child's home life. Yet it could have been out of a comic strip or something, so I didn't hold the parents responsible. But they are mimics. And they're trying out life in their pretend-like play. They're trying out real life. That's the way they get ready for life, is through pretend-like play. And parents should maintain their individuality and cultivate their own interests and talents. The time, feelings, and interests of both parents and children should be respected. You see, if the parents do that, then they'll be happy individuals, they'll have a happier home. They won't be resentful. They won't be burdened down with the martyr complex, and they'll be able to help a child develop into a mentally healthy person. Another thing they said is really listen when your children talk to you. Parents should really listen to the children from a child's earliest years, which means giving undivided attention, putting aside one's own thoughts and beliefs, and trying to understand what the child is saying from his or her point of view. As one parent stated it, no matter how busy or involved you are, listen to your child as a person. You know what happened to Dibs. Has anyone read the book Dibs? It's in the library. So if you haven't, it's just a tiny little book, but every parent should read it. Every teacher should read it. Dibs had parents who were supposedly very intelligent. His mother was an MD. His father was an engineer. And it seemed like the kid just wasn't smart enough to please his parents. Everything he said was stupid and dumb as far as they were concerned. And he couldn't say anything that they would take as something worth listening to. So before long, he just shut up. He didn't say a word. He became completely aphasic. And they hired a therapist, Virginia Axline. Virginia Axline is the one who writes this book about the play therapy she took him through. And the only person who would listen to him at home was the gardener. But anyway, when she finished with this boy who was supposed to be so stupid and couldn't say anything worthwhile, they tested his IQ at 170. So here again, we need to listen, no matter how stupid we might think it is. It might be very precious. Just the fact that we are listening will help the child develop a self-image of a person who is worthwhile in this world. And encourage him to express his feelings or her feelings, both good and bad, and allow the child to show hostility or anger without fear of using your love. Unless they're able to express their feelings, there's no way we know of what might be going on inside the child. In offering guidance to children when they have problems, the parents recommended that you be brief. State your thoughts in a few sentences rather than make a speech. I used to love to listen to a psychologist in the Oklahoma City schools who would talk about two parents about parenting. And one of the illustrations he gave was a child who came in to his office, and usually he asked them to draw a picture of whoever seemed to be the person that was causing this problem. And this one child drew a picture of his mother facing the wall. And he said, why did you face your mother to the wall? He said, if I turned her around, it would have been yakety, yakety, yak. They also felt it is helpful to make children understand that although your door is always open to discuss difficulties, before you will offer solutions, you expect them to have thought it through themselves and have tried to come up with proper solutions. And until they do that, you can't be too effective as a helper, otherwise they may depend too much on your ideas, and they should have ideas of their own in practicing problem solving. Forbidden fruit is also so tempting, so play it low key with undesirable activities, TV shows and so forth. Kids will usually respect your opinion if you're honest, and they will tend to follow your guidance unless they just have to find out for themselves. Recognizing that it's difficult to let children go, the parents advocated gradually allowing them more and more freedom or control over their own lives. By fostering independence, you will not only gain their affection, but also their respect, and their self-respect will grow. Children should be given freedom to make decisions regarding minor matters first. Then the areas of decision making should be expanded gradually. The parents also observed that children have a continuing need for parental support and encouragement throughout adolescence and young adulthood. And also, I might add, after they themselves become parents. As one parent expressed it, once your children are old enough, kind of phase yourself out of the picture, but always be near when you are needed. Be realistic. The value of developing realistic expectations about child rearing was also mentioned. Parents advised that one should expect to make mistakes and to realize that outside influences, such as peer group pressure, will increase as children mature. But if you have helped them develop a real self-respect, and they will not give in to peer pressure so easily, but they have to have a feeling that their opinion is just as good as the next person, and they'll be willing then to stay by their guns and stand up for the things they have been taught are right. Don't expect things to go well all the time. Child rearing has never been an easy job. It has its sorrows and heartaches, but it also has its great joys, and this is what makes it worthwhile. There are no perfect parents. So don't try to be one, or you'll be very unhappy about the results. We have to allow ourselves to be imperfect and allow our children, by the same token, to be imperfect. Parenting is not a simple task, and it's easy to become confused and uncertain at times. That's why I think it's so helpful to have parenting groups that can get together regularly and talk about these things. Plain old-fashioned parents' sense seems to be a good antidote to the passing fads and the idealistic theories which abound in child-rearing psychology. Although the parents I surveyed, this is Schaefer talking now, were mainly from traditional two-parent families, parents in other circumstances can, of course, apply these guidelines to their own situations. For example, single parents or parents in families in which both spouses work may not have a lot of time to spend with their children, but the quality of the time spent playing and talking with their children, doing things together as a family, is equally important. Similarly, while these parents emphasize the importance of a good marital relationship and the need to spend some time away from their children with their spouses, single parents can foster a healthy personal adjustment by arranging time to be alone or to participate in activities with other adults. The most important thing that parents in this study learn by experience is that undeviating love must go hand in hand with discipline. That indeed, one is not truly possible without the other. Moreover, in order to love and discipline most effectively, it is necessary to spend constructive time with the children. It would seem then that while adjusting to changing times, it is important for parents to hold fast to these and other basic unchanging principles of child rearing. In conclusion, and we'll have time to talk a little bit after this, I'd like to read an anonymous piece here that I'm sure most of you have heard, 13 Ways to Mold a Child. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with fear, he learns to be apprehensive. If a child lives with pity, he learns to feel sorry for himself. If a child lives with jealousy, he learns to hate. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns to be confident. If a child lives with praise, he learns to be appreciative. If a child lives with acceptance, he learns to love. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with recognition, he learns to have a goal. If a child lives with friendliness, he learns justice. If a child lives with honesty, he learns what truth is. If a child lives with friendliness, he learns that the world is a nice place in which to live. Now, do any of you have experiences you'd like to share? Good ones, bad ones, questions? Do you pretty much agree with Schaefer in his conclusions? Yes.
I guess one question I would just like to throw out. One of the points that was mentioned was that it's important for you to expect your children to show respect for the other members of the family, or encourage them to show respect for other members of the family. And we have three sons. I guess I don't know quite when I should involve myself when they get in their little fights and name-calling, you know, two of them may gang up on the other one and so forth. When to involve myself when it's really getting hurtful to one of them.
Well, that's,
and when to let them try and work that out on themselves.
Yeah. Well, I think you're wise to stand off and wait and see just who, keep an eye on your children. You know, a lot of child abuse is caused by siblings who are not supervised. So we need to at least know what's going on. But I don't think we should interfere in every little argument. I mean, they have to learn how to cope. And boys have to do a certain amount of physical, you can call it fighting and rolling around. And I mean, they've got to get it out of their systems. That was one of the problems that was wrong. That was one of the things that was wrong with the little Mark I was telling you about. He had been given no physical outlet. But if you can organize games where they can get rid of this, it's much healthier than if they are fighting out of sheer boredom.
And well, it's not always physical either. Sometimes it's, you know, just name-calling type of, you know, two may gang up on the other one, and it's not always the same two. But.
Well, that takes wisdom, doesn't it? And nobody can give you a pat answer on that unless, you know, somebody comes and lives in your home and watches themselves. But I wouldn't remember, our kids aren't perfect and we aren't perfect, so we have to do the best we can. And I certainly wouldn't encourage fighting, but a certain amount of it is to be expected when there are three boys involved. It's I guess it's part of their development. But cruelty has to be watched. I mean, that should not be allowed. And this goes along with cruelty to animals too, to pets. Because children who are cruel to pets or have to be cruel to each other and vice versa. Anybody have any ideas here?
Well, I'm thinking a lot of times it's because they're frustrated and angry.
Yeah.
And if you can discover what they're angry about and give them another option to get it worked out. You know, they're frustrated because they think whatever the other person is doing is unfair. They're mm-hmm. not sharing. I remember with my brothers, I had to work it out. We had a sled, one sled for three of us. And they let me share it, but I got to go on up the hill. Years of frustration to work out on that.
Thank you. That's very good. Yeah, every church to do that. Well, it's time for lunch. And thank you very much.
Thank you.